We are starting a new series, 15 weeks in the Psalms. We've done this in the past, and so we're making our way through the Psalter, and we are in Psalm 31. So if you want to find the Psalms, it's in the middle of your Bible. If not, if you look in the table of contents, you will see it. Begins with a P. P's silent, I guess. Psalm 31, to the choir master, a psalm of David. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. And for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me. And you are my refuge. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love, because you have seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul. You have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. Because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel. For I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you, in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight, but you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage for all who wait, all you who wait for the Lord. May his word live in us. Let me pray for us. Father, we ask that as we take an extensive look at Psalm 31, that you would encourage us, that you would convince us of your vindication, of your justification, that we would know it. In your Son's name, amen. A few months ago, maybe more, I was walking on the square. It was a Saturday. And there are musicians that congregate outside the courthouse there. And they were bluegrass musicians and they were playing. And I was walking down the sidewalk. I was on the Beth Marie side of the square. And I was watching the musicians play. And I wasn't looking in front of me. And I ran smack dab into one of those signs. Now, thankfully, it was in between buildings. There, I didn't do it right in front of Beth Marie's or right in front of the Loophole or right in front of the chestnut tree or something like that. And my first thought was, oh, no, who saw that? Because I looked like a huge idiot at that point. I was wide open to public ridicule at that point. Now, David isn't speaking of that kind of shame here. He's speaking of a public campaign against his character. And there are two major concerns in this psalm. One is, I need my character vindicated or justified. And two, I need to believe that it will be vindicated. All right? I need it, and I need to believe that it's actually happened. So first thing we're going to look at and I'll cue you when we go to the second one, is I need my character vindicated or justified. We're going to look at verses 1 through 5, verses 9 through 13, and verses 17 and 18. But before we get there, I want you to think about this, because David says, don't let me be ashamed. And there's all sorts of different kinds of shame. The primary one here is, you know, the public campaign against him. But I think you can work your way out from there to the different shame that you and I experience. I mean, you've got the signpost kind of shame, right? The fairly innocent mistakes where one's character can withstand the attack. Look at that idiot. He just ran into a sign. You're responsible, yet at the same time, you're also innocent, so to speak. But then you've got the lunar picture shame. When I was a teenager, I was an idiot. And I was in the company of idiots. And we were on a youth retreat in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And we had done many, many bad things. Do not take this for license that you can therefore do bad things. But we had thrown furniture out the window and set off smoke bombs and things of that nature. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that I have pass this down to my children. But the main speaker of this youth conference was going to come and talk to us, but, you know, kind of encourage us. But he was the Christian celebrity. I can't remember which one it was. But this girl that was part of our group, who was kind of annoying, said, will you take my camera and take pictures of him while he's giving you, you know, the lecture? And we were like, sure. Now, you need to understand, this is 1982. You didn't have digital cameras. You had film cameras. You couldn't preview what you were taking. And so, lo and behold, the speaker didn't show up. And we had the annoying girl's camera in a room full of teenage boys. And so we decided to take some lunar pictures, if you get my drift. And you couldn't preview what was happening. And so I, of all the people that the lunar pictures were taken of, was looking back. So a few weeks went by, and I hear her scream at the end of the hall at school, David, wasn't you disgusting? And she shows everyone, I was 100% guilty, yet I needed vindication. There's that kind of shame. Then you've got the clean out your desk shame. I used to work for a church, we'll go nameless, down in Miami. And they were, they were of the devil. And they came after me. And my wife can testify to this because she knows how bad I am. And she said I was innocent. And they had a public campaign against me. And you've got that shame that's out there. Or maybe you've got the shame just of the basic effects of the fall. If you've ever endured a disease or the aging process, there's shame that goes with that. Or the shame of the outworkings of the Genesis curse, the bearing of children, the pain that's involved in that, rearing them, raising them, or the pain that's involved in the frustration of work, dealing with all sorts of human beings, and you're ashamed of the stuff that you are required to do. All of this is encompassed when David says, don't let me be ashamed. Now, David is primarily speaking of his assassinated character. And so in verses 1 and in verses 9 through 13 and verses 17 and verses 20 and 21, he's crying out to God, vindicate me. These people are coming after me. They're lying about me. They're saying awful things about me. I need you to vindicate me. And these are some of the things that he says he needs to have fixed. If you look at the verses 1 through 5, he goes, in you, O Lord, do I take refuge. You take refuge when you are exposed to the elements or you are exposed to that which is threatening your existence. When shame becomes a reality in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve do two things. They sew together fig leaves so that they are covering their shame, because now they are exposed and they understand that we are now no longer naked and unashamed, but we are naked and ashamed. And when they hear the sound of God coming into the garden, they book it into the woods, hiding from God. This is what we do. We do one or the other. We make coverings to cover up for our shame, or we hide. We run and hide. So David says, I need refuge. The next thing he says is, I need deliverance. Let me never be put to shame, and your righteousness deliver me. He goes, I don't need you to break me out of jail. This isn't an illegal jailbreak. I need you to, in righteousness, in justice, deliver me. I need the official seal of approval. And I need you to listen to me. Incline your ear to me. I need an attentive ear. I have an adult friend that when he talks to me, every time he says something, a certain premise, he follows it up with, you hear me? And if I don't say, yes, I hear you, he will keep saying, did you hear me? Did you hear me? Did you hear me? Now, it's not a nervous tick with this guy. What he wants is, he wants confirmation that I have heard him, that I understand what he's talking about, that I've assimilated that knowledge, and now I've processed it, and I am ready to make a decision on what he has just said. Those who are in need, which, by the way, is everybody, of vindication, those who are in need of vindication have a need to be heard. Now, why is that? It's because, he says, I need you to incline your ear to me because I need a speedy rescue. When one listens to another, it places the rescue significantly closer. You think about your child crying out at night, I feel sick, or I'm scared. And if you don't answer, they're thinking, oh no, I have to endure. I have to endure this. But as soon as they hear you get out of bed or call back, oh, now my rescue is that much closer. Knowing this, what we might want to do as human beings, fellow human beings with one another, is develop our hearing, not in a paranoid way or an I'm listening for trouble way only, but nonetheless, develop it in such a fashion that we listen to people. And it's the ultimately callous person. If I come to you and say, I'm in trouble, and you go, yeah, I don't know. Hang on, I got other stuff to do. That's not what it's talking about here. What we need is, most of us can hear and respond accordingly. If I say I'm in trouble, you say, how can I help? But what we need to do is to hear the distress and the anxiety and the pride and the fear. We need to incline our ears, which means I have to disincline my attention that I'm paying towards myself and now pay it towards you. I have to see that there's something underneath the surface other than just what you just said to me. And David's saying, I need you to incline your ear to me, because I need a speedy recovery. Fifth thing that he needs is stability and protection. Evidently, though, they are non-existent. He goes, I need you. He commands God, be a rock of refuge for me. Be a strong fortress to save me. So he says, this is what you must be. And when you're doing that, for you are my rock and my fortress, for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. That means for God's name's sake, our guidance and direction find their purpose in glorifying God and not ourselves. Notice that he says he's being removed out of the net there in, where is it? Verse 4, for you take me out of the net they have hidden for me. And then he commits his spirit into God's hands. The hands that freed him and brought him and rescued him, now he commits his spirit into those hands. Have you ever set somebody free from trouble? You've given them money, you've listened to them, you've brought them to a certain place, you've bailed them out yet another time, and then only to watch them run back into harm's way? Have you ever done that with somebody? Why? Do you think those people have a death wish? No, the reason they run back into harm's way, the reason I run back into harm's way, is because they think, I've got this. Now that I've been taken out of the net, Now that I've been rescued, I really don't need anybody else's help. I can do it again. I can get it right this time. But what David says is, I've been taken out of the net. I've been shown that I'm completely laid bare. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to commit my life into your hands. And that's a risky place to be. You got me out of the jam, no doubt, God. But the best way for me to stay out of a jam in the modern mindset, even in the ancient mindset, is, okay, what I'll do is I'll avoid the jam, or I'll practice lifestyles that won't get me into a jam again. This is all New Year's resolution stuff, right? I'm going to avoid the bad, and I'm going to practice the good. That's not what David does. He says, I'm going to commit myself to you. I'm going to commit the very spirit of my life and its direction and its path into God's hands. And when you get to the very end of Psalm 31, he says, be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. Because I don't know what's going to happen once I commit myself to your hands. You might tell me, go ahead and do this. Or you might just say, let's wait a while. Let's wait a lifetime. You let me be in charge of your life instead of you being in charge of your life. Now, think about it. Jesus quotes this verse while he's on the cross. I commit my spirit into your hands. And he is not thinking, all right, I'm saying this, but as soon as I breathe my last, I'll be standing at the pearly gates and everything will be rosy. No, as soon as he commits, he goes, I'm committing myself into your hands. And when that happens, what awaits me is judgment. If I am bearing the sins of the world, I'm not going to paradise. I'm going to judgment. But I'm also awaiting the resurrection. I'm going to trust both judgment and salvation. And the follower of Jesus, what we like to call Christians, when we commit our lives to God, we're saying we are committing ourselves to your judgment and to your salvation. Every person who has time to contemplate his or her death knows this. You walk out here and get hit by a bus, you don't have to worry about it. But if you are make it to whatever point, you start thinking, I'm committing myself into your hands. And what that means is judgment and salvation. All right. How else do we need vindication? Verses 9 through 18. David says, when you're in the thick of it, that's when you need it. Verse 9, he says, be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. In verse 10, he goes, I've got physical and emotional exhaustion, and it's like a snake eating its tail. The more I'm physically exhausted, the more I'm emotionally exhausted, the more I'm emotionally exhausted, the more physically exhausted I become, and it's just this constant spiral. Verses 11 through 13, he goes, the societal, friendship network, Facebook community, town gossip, school chatter, family tribunal is in full judgment mode when it comes to me. They are chattering about me. They're lying about me. They have forgotten me. If I show up, they run from me. I'm as though I were dead. I'm like a broken piece of pottery only to be thrown on the dump. There's a line within, I think it's A Mighty Fortress, but it talks about terrors without and terrors within. The terrors without here, from the outside, from the community, from your friends, from your church, from your school, from the voices in your head, feed the terrors that are within. They feed the contempt, they feed the fear, they feed the indifference. And they do it with half-baked truths, they do it with flat-out lies, they do it with total disregard for a person and their reputation and their family. And David is saying, look, I'm in the land of bullies. I'm in the land of mob mentality. The scared who will do anything to take the attention off of themselves and will seize any opportunity to climb the societal ladder. If they're making fun of you, they're not making fun of me. If they're coming after you, they're not coming after me. So I'm going to feed that. And David goes, I'm in the midst of that. Pay attention there to verses 11 through 13. Because of my adversaries, I've become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, an object of dread to my acquaintance. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I've been forgotten like one who is dead. I've become like a broken vessel. I hear the whispering of many. They keep saying, look, it's terror on every side. That's like a name they've got for them. As they scheme together against me, and as they plot to take my life. And the reason why I want you to pay attention to those verses, because my guess is that at some point in your life, that's been you. Not the victim, but the perpetrator. You've done this to people. You've done this to your brother. You've done this to your sister. You've done this to the kid at school. You've done this to the politician. You've done this to some celebrity that you don't even know, you know, by blogging and making your posts and all these things. We all do this. You know, I like doctors. I'm appreciative of them. I had to use one recently for surgery. But there's a part of me that wishes that every procedure that a doctor has to enact on you, that they go through it themselves. You know, if he wants to cut me open, let him get cut open first. Because, I mean, he's got all sorts of knowledge, or she's got all sorts of knowledge that can say, your recovery time is going to be like this. You're going to feel a little discomfort. You're going to feel a little pressure here and there. But they really don't know. I would love for them to have the experience of this. Their knowledge of its effects and recovery time would be more than just observation. I don't wish verses 11 through 13 on anyone. But if you've ever experienced this, whether you were the perpetrator or the victim, you will be slow to condemn. You will be slow to ignore. You will be slow to be indifferent and to judge. And even if you do, even if you're quick to do all those things, most likely you'll be quick to repent of it. When Jesus quotes verse 5, into your hand I commit my spirit, he's basically quoting the whole psalm. He's saying, look, by me quoting this one little snippet of the psalm, I'm telling you this is my whole experience from beginning to end. He knew verses 11 through 13 intimately. Therefore, he understands the need we have to be vindicated. But a large part of his knowledge, he learned at our hands. So while he prayed this psalm, like verses 17 and 18, O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. When he's praying that the wicked would be punished and that his shame would be erased, he knew that he would be counted as wicked. He knew that he would be punished, that he would be shamed, so that we, the wicked, might have our shame erased. He understands your need and my need to be vindicated. Doesn't matter if it's innocent or if it's stupid or if you're just flat out guilty. He understands. All right, second thing. We need to believe that we will be vindicated. Look at verses 6 through 8 and verses 14 through 16 and verses 19 through 24. Verses 6 through 8, he goes, I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols. He goes, look, in order for me to know that I'm vindicated, idolatry has got to be revealed. First of all, it's worthless. And that those who traffic in it are worthy of my hate. Now, I understand we're not supposed to hate people, right? And, you know, even Jesus says, you know, you've heard you should love your enemies and things of that nature. But there's a qualifier here. I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols. And what he's saying is those who are habitual idolaters, who actively and continually hate God till their dying breath. Those who cling to idols, he goes, I hate that. I hate them. To want to know that you've been vindicated, that you're justified, that you are redeemed and safe in the hand of God, and to be friends with and to tolerate and approve and to turn a blind eye to those who hate God is a recipe for, at best, lukewarm Christianity, or at worst, becoming worthless yourself. If you go, yeah, it really doesn't matter that people hate God. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there is idolatry out there, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to separate myself from all that stuff, and I'm going to be over here. I'm going to be over here, and I'll just live my Christian fortress life and not have to deal with that. The best way to actually hate those who cling to idols is to cling to God and to proclaim his peace while you're smashing those idols yourselves. You give no ground whatsoever to idolaters. But your weapons aren't of this world. Your weapons aren't smashing people's dignity. Your weapons aren't smashing their humanity. Your weapons are those which you use to smash the idols of this world. You take every thought captive. Jesus went so far to smash the idols of humanity, so far as to be counted as sin, so that we might be counted as righteous. He goes, I'm willing to be shamed publicly on a cross so that your idolatry will be destroyed, so that that which you cling to can be destroyed. That's how much he hated it. The best way to hate those who traffic in lies is to traffic in truth and in love. Not to tear them apart, not to use their weapons, not to engage in those things, but to actually traffic in truth and love. You heap coals on their heads is the way that it's put. Another way to know that you're vindicated is to recall things. Look at verse 8. You have known the distress of my soul. Verse 7. I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love because you have seen my affliction. God, as I think back on it, your love has been steadfast. You have a history with my affliction. You've seen it. You've experienced it. You've got a history with my deliverance. You've brought me out of all of these things. And because of that, I'm going to confess my faith to you. I'm going to trust in you. Verses 14. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. David is going, if you want to be vindicated, if you want to know that you're vindicated, you trust in God, not in yourself, not in the testimony of others, not in your circumstances, not in the accusations that are being made against you, but rather who God says he is. You are my God, and there is no other. And because of that, I am your loyal subject. Now, saying it doesn't make it so. But not saying it is a surefire way to all sorts of problems. So we're called to confess these things. And you're called to confess your reality in God's hands. Look at verse 15. My times are in your hands. It doesn't mean just your good times. It means your bad times too. It means everything about me, my obedience and my disobedience, my success and my failures are in your hands. The hand of the enemy will plunder the good. They will judge. They will accuse. They will come after me. They will cast me aside. But I'm going to place myself, warts and all, inside your hands. Because there it is safe compared to everything else. And when I do that, I'm going to seek a benediction. Look at verse 16. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. Most people in the Old Testament, when they saw the face of God, they died. What David says here is, I need to see your face and live. I need to know that I'm justified. I need to follow David's lead here and seek the face of God and say, your steadfast love is my salvation. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to the cross I cling. I'm coming to you, bad and good, and I want you to bless me. Because of what Jesus has done, I want you to bless me. And when I do that, I'm going to now recount all the good things that I know about you. Starting in verse 19. Oh, how abundant is your goodness that you have stored up for those who fear you, who revere you, your goodness. And you've worked, you've made, you've ordained for those who take refuge in you. This goodness that you've worked and that you've stored, you haven't done it in secret. You've done it in the sight of mankind. These are good things about who you are, God. And because of that, you cover me with your presence. You hide me from the plots of mankind. You store us in the shelter or the tabernacle where your presence is, where your glory is, where your holiness is. You bring us in, not to judge, not to obliterate, but to cover us, to vindicate us. And then he cries out, "Blessed be the Lord," in verse 21, "for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. You heard me even when I didn't believe you. I had said in my alarm, 'I'm cut off from your sight.' But even then, you delivered me." And then the last thing that we do to know that we have been vindicated is that we command ourselves and others. Look at verses 23 and 24. "Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful." Why are we loving the Lord? Because the Lord preserves the faithful. He is now declaring you faithful even though you know you're not. We love him because he declares us faithful because Jesus is faithful. That God abundantly pays or repays those who act in pride. Yet Jesus on the cross is cloaked in the pride of mankind. And so why does he say, "Love the Lord"? He goes, because he's not going to pay you back for what you are. He's going to pay you back for what you aren't. He's going to pay you back for what Jesus was, not for what you were. And he's going to pay Jesus for what you were instead. You can know that you are vindicated and justified because of the Lord's faithfulness, his mercy and grace, extending and preserving the faithful. The only faithful that exist are those to whom he has credited it to their account. And he can say, "It is finished," because the abundant payment to Jesus was made in his life and in his death. And then David says, "Therefore be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord." Belief that you are vindicated requires strength and courage, because what we do is we wait. We hope. The assassinated character, the depressed, the failed, the sick, the grieving, the dissatisfied, the forgiven who still know their guilt, believe that they are vindicated by the very fact that they wait. They persevere in God's hope. They wait for the Lord who is past, who in the past has redeemed them. They wait for the Lord who in the presence hides and delivers and protects them. And they wait for the Lord who in the future will fully restore them. This is the call of this psalm. How do I get justified? And how do I continue to know that I am? Wait upon God. Come before him. Recount his goodness. Remember his steadfast love and the things that he has poured out on you. This is how you know. Okay, we do that now as we come to this table. So before we do that, pray with me the corporate prayer of response, and then we will come to the table. Pray with me. You find it there on page 7. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be.